had was Norm Saunders.
Who was that?
A lot of fun, and if he were here now, he'd be 100 years old. That's pretty amazing. So when I was born, you know, I was born in 54, and he would say, well, I was born in 1907, and it really sounded old. You could barely find pennies from 1907. And it seemed like, you know, way before Charlie Chaplin and all that stuff, and I was like, he actually helped out in the projection of the Birth of the Nation in his town when he was a kid. But anyway, he's a really great guy, and I'm really glad to be here for you guys. So I brought slides to give you an idea of who he was, and also you know, what his collection was that he had afterwards. A lot of people ask me about what paintings we left with. So let's get started. So, in one word, what was Norman Saunders? I'd say he was irreverent. This is his high school photo of his graduation in high school. And it's so long ago, and he was so old, you guys only got to meet him when he was 75 or something like that. But he is the guy in the Screw Bowl in the center with the policeman outfit on, with Hal and sideways. And I actually know a couple of the other people in the photograph, and they just said he was just a true character. He was really legendary in that little town. And this, I think, was Badger, Minnesota, where he graduated high school. Anyway, he took a nice correspondence course and worked his way down to Minneapolis eventually, and walked right into Fawcett Publications, which was making Captain Billy's Quiz Bang. And this is one of his really nice covers that he eventually did for Captain Billy. Fawcett put out Modern Mechanics. I'm sorry that, you know, our image is a little bit trimmed off. So this is one of the earliest paintings that Dad had kept. And this was another cover from Modern Mechanics, 1932, I think. And it's really beautiful. You know, Minnesota freezes over completely all the time. So this is the concept of a motorcycle. Like probably somebody could identify actually what the heart of that motorcycle is, but I can't. But it has a spiked wheel on the back and these like razor blade glides on the side so that you can ride it on the ice and take some fellow that's, you know, skating behind you at 100 miles an hour on the ice. And when you fall down with this guy, you'll get back up. And this is a little long thing that did covers for other magazines while I was working in Fawcett's. And, this is the Elks, like the club, you know, the Elks Club. And they put out a monthly magazine up until the 60s, I think. And it's one of his early old covers. And he came to New York in 1934 and started selling them. Because out at Fawcett's, he worked and competed with the Rosens. And you know, often he got better, more assignments, more frequently and stuff. And then the Rosens worked for Delcourt in New York. And so he just said, well, if I can beat Rosen at Fawcett's and Delcourt, I should just go to New York and keep working with the big league. And so he went to New York and just kept making, really, within 5 months, he was had all the work he could possibly do. He was very, very happy. Working as an illustrator in the city. And we don't have any of the original saucies, so these are just a representative sampling of the proof sheets that he kept. But we don't have the names. And I'm just speeding this along. So after that, you know, as you guys all know, he got lots and lots of really great covers before the war. And these are Ace Publications. At the same time, he was studying with Harvey Dunn, who was basically the protege of Howard Pott. therefore NCY. And Harvey Dunn probably had the best school in America at that time for what they called commercial art at the time. It was at the Grand Central School of Art. And he studied with him in the evenings for 4 years. And one of the assignments that Harvey Dunn gave him was to just take whatever magazine, like in those days it was Click, I think Pick was another one, and it would be what in the my lifetime was the Life magazine type magazine, and just filled with fun photographs that looked like a kind of newsreel thing, and just draw everything that's in there just to give yourself good practice. So these are beautiful sketches that Dad did. You can see the little date on it, December 29, 1941, and it was just he would go from the front to the back of every magazine drawing with that, and he just gave himself an assignment that he would do it, and for a solid year, and just as part of the exercise that he was doing. So these are just if you found an old copy of the magazine from June 9, 1941, those would be all the pictures that he saw, like either in the newspaper or in some sort of photo journal. And he thought that this was something that just really, really helped him a whole lot. So this is the kind of challenges that really great artists like Harvey Dunn was passing on to other people to help them to just become, you know, to get in contact with themselves and be more inspired and be able to just really do good work. So these are never the same and stuff, but in 42, he was in the Army, and he was 36 years old, but they actually expanded the draft from, I think, 17 years old to 36 as part of the mobilization. And everybody was very happy to go, basically, as far as my father's experience was. And he was bored, and he was, because of his age, I guess, they made him a prison guard for Nazi prisoners from Europe, and he was working in a, you know, destination unknown kind of prison camp, but it was in Louisiana, and he was a master sergeant, and there are all these great photos of him with a Thompson submachine gun and a master sergeant and a jacket, and he was Sergeant Saunders, and in the 1960s, it was a lot of fun watching combat with Sergeant Saunders. he would tell everyone in the neighborhood that those were all stories of his exploits. And he had the photographs to prove it. There's pictures of him standing here with all these Nazis, and it was pretty wild. But nevertheless, he thought it was kind of boring, and so he finally, he told him, or he always said that he gave some guy in the Army a case of whiskey and to get transferred to something more interesting. And they trained him in camouflage painting, and he was shipped to China and worked with the Lido-Burma Road going, you know, from Assam, India, through Burma, North Burma, which was still under siege by the Japanese, and then up into the south, western China, up to the Yangtze and the Yunnan province, to bring gasoline and everything else they could possibly give to the Chinese army, because the Japanese had basically surrounded China's all of its ports, and so China was basically being starved and then occupied by the Japanese, I think, for more than a decade at that point. So the Americans did this incredible thing of building the Burma Road, which originally only went to Burma, but they had to go basically through the Himalayas, I think, to get into China through another route coming through, basically using Calcutta as a port. Anyway, so he worked for 2.5 years in China and did the most incredible watercolors. And they didn't really need, once they defeated the Japanese in Burma and drove them south to Rangoon, there was a no more need for bombing protection with camouflage. So this is a gasoline pipeline. Those would be cans in the back and the pipes and stuff. And they would just fill up, you know, reservoirs to get the gas piped through the Himalayan mountains, and they didn't need to camouflage because there was no more bombing from the Japanese. So we had air superiority or whatever. And so as actual officers in charge of General Pike, who was in charge of the Lido River Road, Dad got a job working for Life magazine to do illustrations of the experience for the Army Corps of Engineers. And so they just said, go to it. And so he went to it. And so for the next 2.5 years, he was just a kind of a loose cannon with credentials and to explore China and paint whatever he saw and record it. And these are just incredible pictures. That's Chiang Kai-shek up there instead of Buddha. And that's like some beautiful old temple that was just turned into a, I think it's a Red Cross sort of education thing for Chinese soldiers. So this is just, for my father, he considered these the most important artworks he ever did in his life. And it's kind of a funny thing in terms of all of his training up until this point. He had a lot of technical knowledge because of the modern mechanics, and he had great you know, action, adventure, and sexual stuff that he could bring into it. And from working with the Pulse, as a successful guy doing that. And but it just made him just go wild with the freedom of being able to really explore another country. His own father, oddly enough, fought with General Pershing in the Spanish-American War, and went to the Philippines and was shot by a Muslim sniper, and had opium for the rest of his life in order to survive the pain, supposedly. And so Dad had this incredible father to live up to. And so when he was in China, he was finally living up to these incredible fables of his own father, who eventually wound up as a trapper in northern Minnesota, where Dad was born. So for him to finally one up his father this way was something, I think, spectacular for him emotionally. And he created these great things. Life magazine backed out of the story, and it was basically said that once the war got to a certain point, there was no longer really a propaganda machine at work trying to say how great China is, and we all have to stand behind China. And up until that point, it was a kind of a big propaganda issue to get Americans to okay the idea of sending so much of our sort of like a Marshall Plan thing just to China, when they themselves were a questionable nation and hadn't quite gotten their act together. And immediately after we pulled out, the communists, you know, basically took over immediately, and the nation sort of collapsed in a sense, in terms of this fledgling concepts of democracy. But anyway, Dad was having a ball at this point. He came back to America and tried to get his act back together again and rethink of himself as a illustrator. But he did actually have about 8 articles published of his China sketches Slick magazines during the war. So although the Life magazine one fell apart, he kept actually doing lots of illustrations for different human interest magazines or whatever you call it. And it was fun because he actually illustrated them and wrote them also. So it's like Sergeant Song is reporting from India or something like that. And there it's kind of unique in the sense of most of the other pulp illustrators have nothing remotely like that in their experience, you know. And so the war brought interesting opportunities for my father, and he loved being able to write and invent his own stuff. So he came back, and everything was in jumble, obviously, trying to figure out where the publishing industry was going and how he would fit into it or something. And it's just everybody had to rethink their old career expectations. So he decided that he was going to really make I can't handle that. So he kept working at a lot of different houses, and everybody else was, the industry was in disarray, let's say, basically. But he found himself in a funny position because he's very practical and very good and charged as much as everybody else, which was like $100 for a cover. And everybody still was thinking he was going to go from there into something more interesting. But so they were kind of really willing to buy time. But in the meantime, he got a lot of assignments, hundreds and hundreds of assignments in 48, 49, 50, 51 from the Pulse. And so he kind of was making much more money than he'd ever made before during the demise of the industry. He said that a lot of the publishers just felt that, you know, they can't pay anything, they're going out of business, they had complete leverage over the artists at that point, and they could actually lower the prices and say, well, I'm sorry, you know, all we pay is $90 or something. And so the artists would have to accept it, basically. And at that point, when my father came back from the war, they would say, well, if you got $90, we can get him, we'd rather have him than other people. And so he actually got like way too much work, and so for popular, he was just working endlessly, but at the same time, he was doing paperbacks and comic books at that same era, because the publishers were all the same guys trying to figure out what's the right format that they can be making a fortune off of. This one should look familiar to Mark. This one I've never even seen. And if anyone's ever seen this, I'd love to know where it was published. That's a Star Western. So Popular did some, cost-cutting measures or something. And they were trying to tell all their tax people that we have X amount of money invested in properties like our printing presses and stuff, and they're devalued every year because they go through the usage and stuff, so we're devaluing our property and stuff. And they said, well, what is this property called, you know, art that you've got? And they said, oh, well, we've got closets, you know, rooms full of paintings. And so this is something we've invested in. And so they looked at it and said, no, I'm sorry, that won't work that way. You're gonna be disallowed that. How long have you been taking this deduction? And so then their people doing accounting for them tried to recalculate that and say, well, wait a minute, now maybe what it is we didn't really buy these paintings. Maybe they were only lent to us by one-time use. It's actually the artists should be paying new sales tax on these paintings. Yeah, that's the way it works. So that should be the deal. Go out to the artists, and the IRS didn't really buy it. And they said, well, okay, well, we have to figure this out. So what is this art in relation to Popular? And they go, I don't know. We have no idea. In fact, we want it out of here. And so my dad and Ralph DeSoto and the other, I'm sure Lillis, the other artists that were working for Popular at that time, Cherry Ocker, they got calls saying, get the hell down here and pick up your paintings. They're way overdue. I don't know why you didn't pick them up. It's complete fiction. But the artists were like, we're busy. Maybe we'll get them next week or something. And there was such a negative energy, actually, because the industry was collapsing and the artists received so little money and so little respect in a lot of ways that a lot of them just said, you know, what, screw you. You didn't help me. Why should I help you? Kind of thing. And they just didn't go down. And, but Dad always felt that, and even after this, I mean, he continued to work for even worse and worse and worse and worse conditions to try and make a living. But he always said that, you know, the key to success, he had a couple of keys to success, but one of them was do the very, very, very best you could possibly do, and don't even think about the money, and overdo it, and you'll just blow their minds, and they'll think in the future, you know, why should I call anyone else who'll call more? And that would be at least a way to guarantee, like, continued employment. So these paintings that are all original bulbs that I've been showing now, these are ones that Popular gave them back, probably in 1953, I think. So these are the paintings that we had as a kid in our house when I was growing up. And to me, they were just a dream come true. You know, I just thought my dad was something super special. And especially this one, I always love this one. It's just such a crazy composition, you know? I don't know, you know, I never knew, like, how the hell he could figure all these things out. But he had models coming in, but how would he actually get this, you know, crashed scene down at the ferry or something, ferry terminal? And, but he actually would go and take a pen pencil and draw everything obsessively. So there are drawings of the dead end sign, the stop sign, the crash car, a close up of the steering axle, how it works, a close up of every single detail, the door, the handles. And but I don't know still how he painted it so that they look so realistic. They all seem to exist within a kind of a form and space and stuff. So I was, and then you can see like her knee and her foot is reflected in the moisture on the sidewalk. I don't know how, because he couldn't get the model wet in a dress down the street, you know, and so, but somehow he could just, he said, like, well, he was beginning to paint, and then he would get into a trance, and he was a terrific chain smoker, and a heavy drinker, but when he would paint, it was the only time ever that he would not, you know, smoke or drink, and so he would get into a painting rhythm or something, and you could go up to him and say, "Dad, it's a phone call." And he it was like you're talking to Mortimer Smurf. I mean, he was without Mr. Bergen around. It was just, and then I met things just working, wouldn't answer you. And he would say, "Well, I have to come up for air every now and then." And so he'd get up and relax and walk around. And but for like an hour, he wouldn't smoke, talk, or anything. He would just be in a trance working. And he said that every single artist makes a whole lot of mistakes and a lot of lucky mistakes. But the difference between a good artist and a bad artist is that a good artist can see when he's made a lucky mistake and has sense enough to leave it alone. And I kind of think that along the idea of him being in a trance was somehow how he was able to convey such interesting and convincing illusionism in his paintings that are really coming from his imagination, albeit with pencil sketches of the ingredients, but somehow they seem to exist as objects. Like you can see in that tire that the white wall inside is, again, it's reflected somehow in the moist sidewalk, but just enough to a degree that it's genuinely illusionistic.
In other words, he didn't have the lighting stuff. He just had the sketches.
Right, it's just a pencil sketch.
The lighting is
dead. Right, right. And so it's a kind of a phenomenal imagination, but he would just splash it out and keep splashing it out until it sort of gave us a convincing sense of believability or something. It's quite impressive. You know, if you put on a magnifying glass and look close to it, like the guy's knuckles and stuff, it's a very strange... A very beautiful illusionism that he creates. It's obviously splashed on, you know, my father obviously loved John Singer Sargent a tremendous amount, and Joseph Christian Landecker. And those two guys, between them, really created a kind of a, it really looks like the famous Franz Hals, basically. And it's a particular type of painting that those three names together are just, they define the kind of painting that's spectacular. And my dad is just definitely painting along using the way in which they manipulate paint. That's his actual hand. This one we never see, is cropped on the cover of the, is it Detective Tales, I think? And there's a guy with a knife reflected in her green sunglasses. A very ghoulish, mean guy, but when you just see the tight face on the cover, it's really incredible to see this beautiful, big composition of a big naked girl with a red background.
And a great suit.
Yeah. But I guess they were afraid you wouldn't catch the eyeballs of the little guy there, so they probably have real close so that you can actually see on the cover of the paper. And these are the more eerie ones I put in also.
I don't feel a pulse. Yeah.
Now, would he by himself?
Yeah. No, he always came up with it himself. And they're very strange, but it's like this. For this one, I see the sketches, you know, he was looking at the steam shovel. He drew it from like five different positions and thinking, like, what's going on? What's kind of interesting or something? And one of the sketches shows it exactly from this position, but he's just developing ideas and bringing them in. Every different publisher, every different art director, and every different artist all have their own bizarre creative relationships together, interpersonal. But my dad's attitude, again, one of his keys to success was that don't ever let them pigeonhole you, he would say. And so the important thing is to paint in your own way, like yourself, and to develop a style that's recognizable in your own style, and then it'll be a Norm Saunders as opposed to, oh, that guy who paints fish really well or something. So he was in dread of ever being only known for one thing, because then he'd only be hired for that. I said, we don't need any more fish paintings, so thanks a lot, pal. So he tried to develop a special style. And the more I look at him in comparison to other painters, I can see that it's really, really, if you, to maybe exaggerate it, to bring it across, it's like he's a cartoonist even more than a painter, because his drawing skills are incredible, and he has a very strong style of drawing that's all his own. But the things he's able to squeeze into spaces, and so we've got a little Dylan in the corner. We've got the guy taking a big kind of an L shape in the middle of the whole canvas. These are like very powerful, almost cartoon-like compositions that aren't very realistic, actually. You put real models in those positions, we look a little different. And if you think of Earl Burkey or Rudy Bolarski, that these people really look like they're people who've been photographed. They really look like they're a human in a photograph. And my father's saying he used models all the time, and he would photograph models too, but these look like a cartoon of a person, more than giving you the impression that that's an actual photo of a man standing there. So that kind of distortion allowed him to basically, if you think about it, like a lot of artists want to have a flamboyant signature when they sign their painting or something, and so you really need to find out what is your signature when you're drawing naturally. And you know, every human being has a signature, oddly enough, which is identifiable by a signature analyst for, you know, the FBI or something. And Dad developed a signature style of drawing. And so his compositions are kind of make-believe, basically, but he uses actual models and looks at them. I can't figure out why everyone thinks skeletons would stick together. And then you get that
bristle
on the outside, at least the thing. So the guy's fingers are a little okay. It's weird. This is an actual breathing apparatus. And this, again, harkens back to Dad's formative years with modern mechanics, where everything was like building an actual machine. And so in 1950, this was an effective and serious form of underwater breathing apparatus. But now it just looks like some Martian bell jar or something. That's weird. The skeleton is held together too for some reason.
Yeah,
he's got a wedding knife. Yeah, the knife is dripping in blood.
Would he sign things?
Yeah, he always was happy to sign everything. They would sometimes prop it out, but not intentionally or anything. But he would also not sign a tremendous amount of stuff. But at this point, there was no longer the competition between like the four or five different big publishers that he might have been working for before the war. So there really wasn't an issue about signing them for him.
I think we can share the actual source if somebody has some sort of
presentation. Yeah, these are. These were famous fantastic mysteries, and they were specific stories. The other ones, he would just bring in oddball stuff that was related to the theme, and they were very happy to get it. And there was almost never any question that they necessarily relate to in the story. But I think in the science fiction ones, there was, I think, a specific, I believe.
The lighting on that ship.
When Dad pulled out this painting when I was a kid, this is the first time in my life that I thought, oh, wow, I think my father is a genius. And look at that painting. And somehow this was the one that convinced me as a kid that my father wasn't just that weird big guy, you know, but that he really was special somehow. And a funny thing happened was these guys that, a big collector of science fiction pulps, was a graphic artist guy in New York called Wade Gelman, and he finally got hired by a bubble gum company that said, can you come up with some good ideas for us to, because we're making these baseball cards, can you make a little book of work that would make some more money on these, get kids interested? So he was kind of like an idea guy, doing stuff with Topps bubble gum, and he loved this painting and loved my father's work, and was a fan of my dad's, in a sense. And he asked some other guys that he had working for Topps if they would could get in touch with Norm Saunders and stuff. So he started working for Topps Bubble Gum Company because of that painting. I always thought that was kind of cool. The day later on, they marched attacks and all that stuff. And it was kind of because of that painting. This is a very, very late, 58 Western romances. And this is the photograph my father used of him and my mom. And I'm in the down there on his foot. So, wow. That's me at 4 years old. And I might have made it into the to this pulp. So this is the closest I personally get to being in a pulp. There's a little boy down in the corner inside of the Pioneers where they're getting off of the this is like the mail order bride that shows up on the
out.
Was that right?
Were you cropped out?
I think that you can see little kids in there. But I was basically, when we were both posing like this, nobody could babysit, so I was wandering into the actual photograph.
He's like,
please,
let me in.
Yeah. So it was fun. I actually did pose for my dad a lot. Everybody was, even all our neighbors had to pose for him and stuff. That's my claim to fame right there. When the pulps were really on, Dad thought, well, okay, Walter Baumhoffer and Tommy Lovell were both making a Western art. And, during those years, my childhood, my formative years, the guys were all coming over to our house and trying to game plan what the hell they're going to do to readjust to this terrifying world of poverty, basically, and obsolescence. They were no longer in demand at all. And so everyone had their own idea. Like Ray Kinsler, who'd been, pen and ink guy, was saying, oh, we got to start doing portraits, And Tommy Lovell was like, I think we should do Western art, like really good stuff. So Dad started making Western art at the time, also to see if he could, and these were like, they would take them to Kennedy Gallery in New York, and, they were trying their best, to find some way to make a living. But Ray, this is what I was talking about, from that, we were talking about that part of the best thing. Yeah. This is what they did, and all of them were thinking that, and Cherry Aka did this, he made a very good living at it as a fine artist doing Western art. But one of the other publishers, Martin Goodman, and I forget the guy that did Liberty. Who did Liberty, John?
McFadden,
right. They both put out good men's magazines, and so Dad got jobs doing those. And that was okay, but he was hoping for something lucrative, So again, these were like $150 bucks. So, And again, I'm posing this one. I have the arm to the far left. Now, this is like, I think, 1966 or something. So I'm 11 or 12 years old. And you know, I'm holding them, others say, oh, it's just fun, you know, to be posing them like that. So these were the men's magazine covers. So these are the men's magazine's interiors. And he really put a lot of effort into these. And in a sense, I mean, they're some of his greatest masterpieces because he really was very, very talented and had a lot of experience in the 60s and the 70s. And so this is his Mars Attacks cards, which at the time, again, he was just getting $1.25 an hour to do them. It was, they sold for about, I think, only about 2 to 3 months. And then they were off of the counters. So at the time, it wasn't so earth-shattering or something, but he continued to work with Topps. And this is a Topps hold-up set he did for Batman. And that was a very popular TV show. At this point, instead of just doing extra little weird things for the sports bubble gum, they began to realize at Topps that they could maybe make just non-sports cards. And so it began a kind of experiment for about 10 years. They kept making different non-sport cards. And at the end of it, they were making Wacky Packs, which was a very popular set. That I think they made 18 sets that my father worked for, about 44 images in each set from 1967 to 1979. And so this was some of the last work they did, was these Wacky Packs for the Topps Bubble Gum. This is the last assignment he ever had. Some really nice guy, I guess Jeffrey O'Brien, I don't remember, the dad boy, he's really nice. And he called him up and said, you know, I want you to maybe do some kind of recreation or something of it. And that's, no, no, I got no idea. This is really good. And so I think this is 1980. This was done. I mean, my dad would be only 73 or something. But it's the last published piece he ever made. Then, basically, Dad, around that same time, 1980, he was contacted by Daniel Goggin and Al Time and John Gunson. And you guys all know who you are. And they're saying, well, we're interested in this stuff called pulp, you know, and we wonder if you'd come out to our pulp con. And it was absolutely like one of those rejuvenation things for him because, you know, he really was just, you know, we were very, very poor, and he was had spent basically from coming back from the war up until like 1980 when pulp con adopted him. On a steady decline, even though his talent and his creativity and his mental capacities were great, but this tie itself didn't have any need for his type of work. It had become very unpopular. I think one of the milestones for me, it's so shocking to find out, was in 1964, a Saturday Evening Post fired Norman Rockwell. Just said, go to hell. And, Norman Rockwell had nothing, you know, to live for, sort of about Saturday Evening Post. And then in the next few years, I think they went bankrupt, and the new people that bought them up and started at the end of the smaller circulation hired them back. And so they did, then later they won. But basically, the 64 on, it was just a real, really, Dad would say it was like I had a business making buggy whips when they invented the automobile. Mm-hmm. It's just that obsolete what he did. And so he always said, well, my whole life's work sold for a nickel at a newsstand, and then people just threw it out, and now it's all gone. It'll never, ever, ever be found again. It's completely, all my life's work is gone. And then suddenly, you guys adopted him and brought him out and to Polkon, and it was an incredible experience for him. It was, as an artist, he just never met the public. He never interacted with anyone other than an art director. And, you know, he never taught publicly or anything. So it was a very much a kind of kind of like the classical idea of an artist in a garret somewhere just working. And here there was a room full of kind and interested people, and it just blew them away. It was really absolutely the most meaningful thing to redeem his life's work for him. And I had become, before that point, kind of devoted to trying to catalog his work and not accept the idea that his work could never be documented, that it was all just wasted. So I began, I actually happened to travel around a lot of the country then, so I would go to any town I was ever in, go to the bookstores, and buy the pulps. And anything I could find, God forbid it wasn't by him, I would make a mistake, because he would be so disappointed and say, "You think I paint good, you know?" And I said, "Oh, Dad, I just got that, you know, myself, yeah." And so I really couldn't make a mistake. And but I had collected a couple hundred here and there and stuff. But I never felt, you know, that it was really being treated with the kind of respect that I was hoping. And then this wonderful guy, P.H. Schrader's, who wrote Paperback USA, interviewed my dad and wrote an article for Dan Zimmer for Illustration Magazine. And he called me up and said, "They don't pay anything at all, but it's a hell of a magazine. They just did the first issue, and I really think they should do something on your dad. He's ready to do it, and he'll print it and make it look good. If you can, it would be great if you could do something on your dad." So I couldn't, you know, I'm always trying to hope that things are going to turn out all right, but you never know. And but I did this article for him, and I couldn't believe it. It came right out, and it was out in circulation, and he sent out, you know, 2,000 copies, and everybody gobbled them up. And so it was really like, for me, a whole new idea that the fandom thing has become so spectacular in my mind. And then afterwards, Dan asked me, "Well, we don't know about lots of the pulp artists, and you know, the information in most of the stuff is pretty inaccurate. Can you? Who else did you know and stuff?" So I did one on Ralph DeSoto, and it was fun to be able to, you know, tell everybody what DeSoto was like. And so then I just continued doing them, and this one's on J.W. Scott. And again, just it was great to find out about these guys. In this case, it's very unusual that his widow is still alive, and but absolutely refused to talk to me or acknowledge that he did anything other than just really nice Western art. So he's one of those guys that made the transition and made a good career as a Western artist, and but, you know, just refused that they're, you know, and completely ignored their pulp heritage. So they were, you know, it's great to be able to give people credit where credit is due, in my mind. One of the things I've always loved was all of these crazy, violent, sexual things that J.W. Scott did that are just classics. Everyone looks at them and goes, "Oh my God, it's so wild." And, but it bugged me that nobody knew what W stood for, or they mixed him up with H.W. Scott. And so I just thought, well, I've got to find out who this guy is and catalog the whole thing. Definitely my favorite of all the other pulp artists was Alan Anderson as a person. And this is the issue that just came out. And it's just great to really to give him the due that I always wanted to be able to give him. This is a photo to make it into the magazine. I think with the help of Steve Kennedy and stuff, we were able to put together incredible hundreds and hundreds of photographs. But I just thought this was one of the cutest ones. That's exactly how I remember him coming over to our house and stuff when I was a kid. This is a funny guy. Just it was a model. He worked with my dad and Cherry Aka and a lot of people. And it was just great to run into him and get his view of it. And most people just, you know, would never think about the modeling side of being in a pulp, that he was actually a star of so many different pulp magazines. It's just bizarre. I don't know if you've seen the article, but the two characters, this is by DeSoto, The one reading the Saturday Evening Post is Richard Willis. Mm-hmm. The other one is Larry Meyer, who is this really kind of pretty good actor and model. And this is a funny medley of all the different artists, Bonhoeffer, DeSoto, my father, and Chariaka, all hamming it up for their different action adventure movies. And it's fun to do the art. I did one on Chariaka too, it's just great. And I thought I would show you, just as in closing, one of my paintings. So this is the kind of work I do. And I can tell you, if you had me on a psychoanalyst couch, that yes, I'm influenced by my dad, but I don't know if you can see it at all. But this is my kind of art that I do. And this is a painting I just did of the Wolfman. It's a tombstone of the Wolfman. And these are what I also do to make money. This is a sculpture I'm making. It's a giant fish floating on the water. And this is another one, I think, it's at the airport in LaGuardia. And so these are like drawing sculptures that I'm making. And that is the end of that. I don't have any time. If anyone wants any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
And I just, the only thing, I think sometimes you have to have a little critical. I only question the Norman Rockwell thing. You know, I think he should have probably been fired from day one. You know, I mean, these people, these giants that you're talking about, like your father, they have a cutting edge. Mm-hmm. They're not jingoistic, mm-hmm. sugar diabetic people mm-hmm. like Rockwell. And they're not posers like Bob King. He never did a real thing in his life. But you know what I'm saying? But, they did different things. They rose with the times. And you know, Rockwell was always rolling money.
One thing
you
know,
I don't include Rockwell to these people. I think he was a terrible influence on just about everybody.
One of the things that's kind of weird is that the, I haven't seen the actual numbers, but I have seen them, but I don't have them registered in my brain. But the size of the circulation of Saturday Evening Post was so large, so tremendously large, that in a sense, doing a horror pulp cover compared to doing Saturday Evening Post cover, in terms of the audience that you're addressing, one is definitely a niche audience, the other one is actual American ambition to have something called mass media. It was just dawning on people, like, what is a huge mass media? Everyone in America, every home gets this thing. And so a lot of the thing that you're responding to, that we say is like, has a cutting edge on the pulse, but no cutting edge. It's actually, I can understand why.
You know where they say 90% of everything is crap? Well, Rockwell was the whole 90%.
They say that already.
The only thing that moved the region was media operators.
Ah, he was the definition of it.
But my dad said that in 1913, the only person he'd ever seen, I think it was 13, who was named Norman in the world was Norman Rockwell. And he always thought, well, I can do it if Norman Rockwell. So my father was actually granted Norman Rockwell and looked up to him. But basically everybody looked up to
Jefferson.
Everyone
deserved to make it be a billionaire.
Here's another interesting thing I just did. It's a funny point, it's unusual. When you work for Saturday Evening Post, you would get an annual contract. And I think the annual contract was for each cover you would do, depending on what decade we're talking about, you'd get $5,000 for the cover. And it was an annual contract that includes like whatever that would be for that year, 24 covers or something they might do. So much money. Then these guys were getting $60-$75 for a full cover. That the concept of getting that much money,
there's
definitely a carrot out there. And there's definitely a need for it.
When Mark Pack was to be this person, did he ever contact the state?
He asked him, why should tax people ever contact me? Tim Burton loves my father and contacted us and asked us to come to the premiere for the film and stuff.
Losing your mind inside.
I was shocked that they don't mention my father's name anywhere. And Tim Burton mentions it in every breath he ever says, and he talks to us about it, but I guess it's a bullshit thing that they mention it. And like, or Topps, you know, wants to retain complete utter ownership or whatever. So they were probably dreaming about merchandising or something. But in any case, it pisses me off that, again, the guy got $1.25 an hour to do it. But he fired everybody, and they made this film in 1997, and they wouldn't put his damn name
in it.
Oh, yeah, sure. I've retained complete rights control over everything, and I'm ready to invade the wall.
So,
it
works. All right, how did that work?
When they gave I'm afraid to talk to you about this stuff.
When they gave you that speech, since you're also giving back the rights to
I can only speak from ignorance. And with new president in the room, I dare not speak anything about it. We are one of the greatest copyright holders in the world. But basically, I like the idea that something called intellectual property belongs to the person that creates it. And I love that. So simple, it's easy to understand. And my father's work was signed, and it's Norman Saunders and stuff, so it's always Norman Saunders.
So you mentioned about popular saying, this is really, you own this, and we just released it from you. So
right.
That should allow you to own it.
They're all just offended at you, so I don't want to hear about it. I just want to, we were going from a guy that was like weeping because no one on the planet Earth heard who he was, you know, in 1980, to, you know, now trying to argue, man, I wonder if I should get a share of this money. So I'm just glad that it's out there. You know. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Art Spiegelman was hired to work for Topps. He's the guy that did Raw and I guess works as a comic editor for the New York now or something. He told that he's only 17 years old. It was like in 1967, I think. Gee, Mr. Saunders, I know all about you. You're legendary. And Dad just started burst into tears. He'd never heard the concept of such a thing. He came home and said, it's amazing. I actually am following this is guy that has heard of you.
Cult of one.
Cult of one. I
should probably. His work he did when he was in China.
I'm sorry, can you
hear me? His work he did in China.
China.
Did he actually do anything regarding flying tigers?
Flying tigers, yeah. Well, they were flying out of an air. Takayaki Airport or something like that. It was like they took it over from the Japanese and they were using this for entire days. And he was there and he illustrated that those scenes, you know, at least all. But he was just doing sort of a reportage, I guess it would be called, something like that. But they were very, very, very important, you know, in that theater to everybody, you know, with barrels and all that stuff.
Did you ever do any decorating?
I can't hear
you. Did you ever do any decorating like nose cone art or any of that?
What kind of art? Nose cone art. Yeah, he did. I was surprised to see that. Yeah, he did. The 1381st core of petroleum storage supply of the Army Corps of Engineers, to this day, it's patched my father's name. This is weird. I got to cut it off. That's it. Thanks for your question.